Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Lynn Casper. Chicago Cubs play-by-play man.
Kyle wanted to sign up that day for karate.
Karate. I wonder if he can handle Kramer.
Seinfeld reference.
Mm-hmm. All the latest news and notes from the Cubs.
Here's the pitch.
Cubs win. David Bodie knocks in Baez. Happy Easter, everybody.
It's the Easter Bodie.
Lynn Casper with McNeil and Parkins on 670 The Score.
This hour on The Score brought to you by Vasectomy Clinics of Chicago. Little White Sox news to pass along before we get to Lynn Casper.
Yep.
Eloy Jimenez will miss the Baltimore series. He has been placed on the bereavement list, and that's a three-day minimum. He has gone back to his hometown in the Dominican Republic to mourn the death of his grandmother.
Yes, it's a minimum of 3 days, according to baseball rules, and a maximum of seven.
So Lynn Casper joins us now on the day off. We appreciate him. He joins us every Monday at 3 on the McNeil and Parkins Show on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, home of F-150s for $229 per month. The Easter Bodie was well done by your partner, Lynn Casper.
Yeah, he knows how to turn a phrase, and I thought it was well said.
Why were you guys due for a 228 game yesterday, weren't you, Lynn?
I think we were just mostly due for 70 degrees after Friday's game was about as cold a day as we've had. We've had a lot of those, and because we go with windows open, it's just nice to have baseball weather back.
In terms of Chatwood, you mentioned on Twitter how happy people were for him in the clubhouse. Can you illustrate what that was like or what you saw?
I think when you have a teammate who, as the word is, he posts, you know, he never makes excuses. He takes the ball when asked, goes through a season like he did last year where he could not find the strike zone. I just think there's a lot of equity that he built up within the clubhouse, the fact that he did not make any excuses, point any fingers. He just said, you know, I'm going to do my best to get better. And the fact that he went out and pitched as well as he did yesterday, I think felt like it meant a little more internally than it would for another guy who maybe went through, you know, a couple of weeks of struggles or maybe was injured. Last year was just a completely lost year for him, and he kept his head up and just kept plugging away, and I think that's why teammates really appreciate an effort like that.
His last relief effort was pretty good, too, prior to yesterday's start, Len. Are you noticing anything different? Yes, he's throwing strikes, but how's he getting there through your eyes?
Well, we talked in spring training, and I think I mentioned him as an intriguing person on this roster because of the year he had last year and what the Cubs thought they were getting when they signed him. And his mechanics, I think he's slowed down a little bit, a little simpler. He does have some herky-jerky stuff going on in his delivery, which you need to keep because it's not only kind of implicit in what he does and has done his whole life, but I do believe it gives him a little deception as well. It helps him hide the baseball. Stuff-wise, I think he has the best stuff on the staff in terms of starting pitchers, better than Yu Darvish even. We were seeing 96, 97 mile an hour sinkers from Chatwood, but the inability to throw that fastball for strikes was what kept him from being successful last year. And after some nerves got to him in the first batter, you know, he was able to get the ground ball in the double play. And the stuff just played. He's got all kinds of crazy movement on all of his pitches. And, you know, you can't expect him to do that every time out. But a swing guy who can do a little bit of everything like Mike Montgomery has the last couple of years, but in the form of a hard-throwing right-hander is incredibly intriguing to me.
Len Darvish got 15 guys out Saturday, and some call it a step. For how long should the bar be five innings for you, Darvish?
Well, Joe said there was a National League poll that he basically wanted to pinch hit for him and that he had every intention of sending him back out for the sixth. I think Darvish could have pitched six, and the bar should be six for this entire rotation. But, you know, in the overall, after he gave up the early runs, the two homers in the first inning, you know, I thought he looked a little better. It was probably, for me, of the four outings, it was maybe two or three on the list, and it was not an improvement on the one previously necessarily, but it was a heck of a lot better than his first outing. So, you know, I think it's been good enough to keep his team in games, but there's still, I think, a lot more in there for you, Darvish. And, you know, I would anticipate that Joe will like to get him up over 100 pitches and hopefully into the seventh inning a couple of times. Because you're right, five innings should never be the bar for a starting pitcher, especially someone of his caliber and with his experience.
We're talking to Len Casper, McNeil and Parkins on The Score. I wanted to just circle back to your Tyler Chatwood point. When you said, you know, best stuff on the staff, is that something that you've heard from scouts? Because that is a superlative. I know it's not a swing and miss staff. It's not a staff that's going to overpower you traditionally, but that still would surprise me given the pedigree of some of these guys.
Well, let's just look at the starters. I guess Darvish would be the one you might quibble, right? You might say Darvish would be the guy, but aside from him, I mean, this is not a velocity rotation. In terms of the bullpen, without Brandon Morrow right now, I'd have a hard time finding another guy who has better stuff even in the bullpen right now than Tyler Chatwood. I talked to Chad Noble a lot, who is the Cubs' bullpen catcher, and it's nasty, and Chad knows because he catches these guys every day. And my hunch is Chad would tell you the same thing, that the Chatwood, Darvish, those are two guys he would put certainly near the top. Alan Webster's got a power slider at 89, throws in the mid-90s. But I'm telling you, Chatwood's stuff has never been in question. And if he can start commanding it like he did yesterday, he can be a big part of this thing.
What are you hearing about when John Lester might next be available?
It's a good question. If you ask John, it would be Thursday. The Cubs have left that spot open, and I would not be a bit surprised if he makes that start. Everything I have heard over the last 48 hours is that the side session or the sim game he threw out the other day went very well and recovered well, and I think one more side coming up, and if that feels good, I would not be a bit surprised if we see him back this week.
In terms of, you know, big picture stuff, why do you think, what are the biggest reason or reasons why this is stabilized?
Starting pitching, number one. Bullpen would be 1A. And then just the consistent nature of this offense, even without consistency from Chris Bryant. And for the most part, Anthony Rizzo before he reached base, I think, nine times in the three games. They've continued to score a lot of runs, averaging maybe just under six per game, which puts them, I think, in the top three or four in the major leagues. But whenever you get on any sort of roll, you have to have good pitching. And when your starters are able to two or three times a week go seven innings and not give up anything, it takes a lot of pressure off the bullpen and makes that part of the club even better. So for me, it's all about the pitching.
They've managed in about 10 days to wiggle their way up to 13th best. Not where you want to be, but 13th best after that 2-7 start in staff ERA at 4.21. They've worked their way to the middle of the pack in some other categories. Would you say you feel they're out of the woods as a pitching staff?
Well, the hard part, guys, with analyzing the micro in a baseball season is that something happens the following day that goes against the narrative, right? And so it's really tough to do that. But I think we would all agree that there was virtually no chance the pitching staff would be bottom of the barrel in the major leagues, right?
I didn't think so, no.
Right. So it won't be as good as it's been the last 10 days. Maybe somewhere in the middle, but I would kind of plant my stake in the territory of I would expect by the end of the year, Mac, for the Cubs pitching staff to be better than middle of the pack. Maybe not necessarily top two or three in the league, but better than worse. And then for me, if you continue to score runs at the rate they have, that's the more intriguing question to me. I've not really worried about the pitching staff that much the last few years, but I think the second half of last year with what happened to the offense did make people kind of step back and look at maybe some individuals and then collectively what not only what this offense is capable of, but if things don't go right, what it would look like. I'm pleasantly surprised it's been collectively this good. And you just want to see the Haywards and the Contreras's and guys like that continuing to be arguably the best offensive forces on your team. I think Brian and Rizzo are going to be fine. I'm not worried about them. But if you continue to get those contributions, I'm not worried about Baez either. But if you get them from Contreras and Hayward, now this lineup looks ridiculously scary and can be as good as it was in 2016.
I'm with you about not being worried about the pitching staff as a whole. I think it has a really high floor, and there's a ton of experience, and it seems like now a little bit of depth in the starting rotation. But each of the last few years when the Cubs have been competitive, they have allocated significant resources to having a named closer, right? Chapman, Wade Davis, Brandon Morrow, and they've blown four saves, and they've converted two this year, and Joe says he's totally fine. He loves it. He loves having managerial discretion to go with matchups for a closer, but they try to build the roster to have a defined closer. How big of a deal do you think it is that it's an undetermined length of time now for Morrow?
I think that's a fair question and it's somewhat leading, and I agree with kind of the way you led me there. You're right. The Morrow part of this is concerning. I don't know yet, Danny, if we're at the point where you write off Brandon Morrow and say anything he gives you is gravy, but we're not counting on it. They were thinking originally he would be back at some point, maybe even in early May.
Right.
That clearly will not happen. But I do think if and when he is back, you still have to have a plan B and cannot count on him necessarily being the guy the rest of the year. They're going to have to be clearly careful with him in terms of back-to-back. So it is incumbent upon the Pedro Strops of the world and I think Carl Edwards Jr. to get back to the big leagues and be a force. So yes, the biggest question for this staff is ninth inning and beyond, but I feel a lot better about the first five or six innings than I think any of us did after the first 10 days of the season. And as I said earlier, I think we were all more surprised by the struggles than we have been necessarily by the success we've seen from that group here the last 2 weeks.
Len, 20 games in for the Cubs, other clubs 22 games. The Pittsburgh Pirates have played 19 games, and I'm starting to wonder what's real? What's real and what is going to change radically by the time this stuff starts to really matter? And the Pirates are tops in almost every pitching category. Is that a mirage?
No, I don't think it is. And here's why I think the Pirates feel like they're for real. Basically, their whole outfield's been injured. They're not even whole yet from an offensive standpoint. They've been without Gregory Polanco. Starling Marte is now injured. Corey Dickerson has been out. Lonnie Chisenhall. Melky Cabrera has been playing a lot in the outfield and got off to a good start. But I think there's more in there offensively for the Pirates, but the fact that they might have the best starting staff in this division and maybe even in the entire National League makes them incredibly formidable. They have a veteran manager who's been through this before. I think the Pirates are intriguing and a little scary to watch.
It's a great division. Yeah. It's a great effing division.
Yep, it really is. And you know, the Reds, after a terrible start, look a little better, and I believe they have a plus run differential despite their less than 500 record. The Brewers might have a negative run differential, which is also interesting because they have all those one-run wins.
They were at an even zero. I've got the standings right here. Brewers, minus two run differential for the year.
Don't discount that, guys, over the long haul. And I know that, you know, some people say the record is what it is. But early in the season, if you see a bad run differential and a good record or vice versa, those things tend to kind of match up by the end of the year. In other words, you're not going to win 90 games and be minus 40 in your run differential. It just doesn't happen.
You doing anything special for Grateful Dead Night on Wednesday or Thursday, whenever it is?
No, as I told Lynn Bramer this morning, I think the Cubs will have to play a seven-hour game in honor of the Grateful Dead. But like it'll go fast for like five innings, and then the sixth through the eighth will take like 3.5 hours, and then a quick finish.
Okay,
I'll watch on TV. Len, thank you as always.
All right, guys. Talk
See
you,
Len. Bye bye.
That's Len Casper joining us each and every week.
I feel like I haven't talked to him in a while.
Yeah.
You know why? I ain't talked to him in a while.
You've had some long weekends.
Catch up, yeah.
not exactly.
Yeah, it's good to see you on a Monday.
Yeah.
How about that?
Is it any different?
No.
I didn't think it would be. This segment is brought to you by Subway. Subway restaurants feature a different 6-inch sub for $3.99 every day. Subway, make it what you want. At participating restaurants, additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied. Something to ask you, though, about one of the reasons you've been away, because it was all over the Chicago media landscape, and I'd be interested in you weighing in. It's McNeil and Parkins on the Score.
It's draft week.
So without any further ado, let's go up to our ring announcer, Chet Copic.
Thank you very much, Gorilla Monsoon. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Rosemont Horizon. This event for the World Wrestling Federation Ladies Championship, one fall, a 60-minute time limit. The challenger from Cork County, Ireland. She weighs 144 pounds. Ladies and gentlemen, Velvet McIntyre. Velvet McIntyre. And her opponent, weighing 160 pounds from Columbia, South Carolina. She is the World Wrestling Federation Champion, ladies and gentlemen, the fabulous Moolah.
WrestleMania 2.
There is nothing Chet Copic wouldn't try to sell. Wrestling, roller derby, you name it. He once wrestled a bear when he was doing network television sports in Indianapolis for the NBC affiliate, I think.
Chicago Bear?
Not a Chicago Bear, no. He didn't wrestle a Chicago Bear. He wrestled a bear.
Who won?
I don't know.
Okay, it was a draw.
I don't know. I'm sure it was one of those trained bears, Dan.
It was a trained bear.
I'm guessing it was a trained bear, yeah.
I'll have to check out that clip.
But yeah, Copic died last Wednesday, and I've had a whirlwind of emotions these last few weeks because, as many of you listeners know, my father is very, very ill after a series of strokes. And then the news of Chet's passing Thursday morning kind of knocked the wind out of me. But I was, as I know you are, as a media geek and a radio guy, fascinated by coverage of something like that. And I got a kick out of John Greenberg's column, as you did, which was about the coverage of Chet's passing.
Yes.
Because that's something Chet would have fascinated about. He would have loved seeing his mug on the cover of Friday Sun-Times.
The little I know about Chet Copic is that Chet Copic loves some coverage of Chet Copic.
He sure does, yeah.
And so
dangerous. Look at that. You can't buy that kind of pub. Look at that.
So, yeah.
Suspenders looked great.
Yeah, so I thought Greenberg nailed it when he said that he would have loved the coverage that he got. He was treated like a monumental figure in the city's history had passed away.
I read every word, at least that I could find, of the places I usually look for sports commentary or media commentary about Copic, and what I thought to be the most accurate, the sharpest perspective on Chet Copic's life was offered by Jim O'Donnell, who I think is a colossal bag as a guy, but I can be objective and say he nailed it. He isolated Chet's life. He pinned down with precision his struggles with his loves, his career, his own personal demons, and Chet had a bitterness that hurt him. It, without question, you know, it hurt his career. He could have had more opportunities had he not burned more bridges. Maybe not in prime time, because I think to some degree the craft, it outgrew him. And he didn't have the ability to ad lib with a partner the way most of us do it. There's very little Sermon on the Mount. Lawrence is one of the few shows in town, and he uses Tony all the time as a sidekick. But he was never very good at taking phone calls, never really wanted to do much of that. But he burned bridges, and nothing can convince me that there wouldn't have been a place where 3-4 hours a week that Chet Kopech wouldn't have made sense somewhere here. But everybody was mad at him because he expressed some pretty nasty stuff along the way. He said what was on his mind, and one time at ESPN Radio, he sent an email to the wrong sendee during a disciplinary action, and that was problematic.
I can imagine.
I had no problem because I tweeted a few things and Facebooked a few things, and you guys were nice enough to have me come on as a guest for 15 minutes, and I put that out there as well. For anybody who missed it, it's on my Facebook and Twitter pages. But some people asked me, what do you think of a couple guys on your station not saying anything about Chet Kopech? Bernsey didn't say anything. Lawrence Holmes didn't say anything. I've never been in the business of telling other guys at my stations I've worked at what they should put on their shows. If they didn't want to comment any more than Dan announcing the news of Chet's passing, I'm totally cool with that. If Dan wanted to rake Chet over the coals, I would have been cool with it. He had reason to. He had personal reasons, and he had professional reasons. And Kopech himself wouldn't have had a problem with it because that's how he operated.
Sure.
He didn't have a problem making enemies. So, you know, I would have been totally cool with it. In fact, Dan and I exchanged some texts about other things over the weekend, but I said, hey, you know, a few people asked, you know, you didn't say a word. I totally would have been cool with it if you did. Not that he worries about what I think.
No.
But I'd been cool with that. Say what's on your mind.
Yeah, I think it's always a balancing act of, do you want to bring up the bad in someone when they die? It's not like you have to pretend that they were a saint, but if you don't have anything nice to say, a lot of people truly believe in
right.
don't speak ill of the dead.
I know. Those people should never be talk show hosts. operate by the, if you don't have anything nice to say, credo.
Well, yeah, but that's a different credo. It's one thing, like, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all, and don't speak ill of the dead. Right, like some people really do feel like it's just in poor taste to speak ill of a dead person immediately
die. I know celebrities. You know, celebrities maybe play by different rules. Locally, he was a celebrity, and there was nothing we celebrated more in the 3.5 years I worked with Chet Kopech than a soundbite we got from Bob Costas not too long after Howard Cosell died, when he just eviscerated Cosell.
Costas did.
Just tore him apart. If you were to cut Howard Cosell open, demons and poison would spill out all over the floor. Like, that's the stuff you get out in that era, the late 80s, to national publications. Rudy Marsky at USA Today, so he writes a story about it.
Sure, of course. Well, I didn't read O'Donnell. It just didn't come across. I don't know him at all.
Yeah, one of the periphery. It's either the Northwest Herald or the Daily Herald. I'm not sure. I get confused on my heralds.
The only thing that I came across, I guess, organically outside of Twitter was when I walked into my condo, Steph watches WGN. That's her local news of choice. And they had a really long feature on the, I guess it was the 6:30 newscast. And it was great. Just so many cool pictures, and it did not talk about any of the demons or any of the things that you do, which is understandable in local TV news. They don't often get into the nitty-gritty of something like that.
Right, it's happy talk.
In an obit piece, but just in terms of the career, like, they got, you know, him and Walter, him and Ditka, him and Jordan, him and everybody, and it painted them as equals.
Yeah.
Right, which is a testament to what he meant in the media landscape of that era.
Yes. In the 80s, he was as big as any media guy in town was, and he had a physical presence as well. I don't have any information today on when the public, or if there even is going to be a public service. I've been in communication with his kids, Chet's kids, Lindsay and Tyler, about a service that is being planned. I'll have more details for you tomorrow. I'm not sure if it's going to be open to the public. My suspicion is it will, but I don't know that for sure. My best guess is Kopic would have wanted a carnival. That's my best guess.
Dangerous. Who you got lined up to eulogize me, kid?
A few people, Chet. I do. I have a few people lined up. I've taken it upon myself to roll up my sleeves and produce the audio portion of the funeral, if there's going to be one. So
good.
Yeah,
how about that? You started as a producer.
That's right.
I'm sure you got a few contacts of some people who will want to say a thing or two.
And I realized, you know, it's just we get a little, you do what we do for a long enough period of time, you kind of become used to it. You get accustomed to what you see every day. And do it for 30-plus years, you really lose sight of you once were a starry-eyed sports fan playing high school sports and wanting to, you know. And then it's Easter Sunday, and you know, just Dan Hampton getting back. And I just wonder, you know, these Hall of Fame guys getting back to me right away and responding positively. And it occurred to me yesterday, I don't know if I would have those numbers had it not been for what Chet Kopic did for me when I was 26 years old. I don't know if it would have gone the same way it did. He gave me my chance, so I will continue to be tremendously grateful to him for all of those opportunities. He promoted the crap out of me.
That was the thing that I learned that I guess I just, I don't know, was a little naive to, but it makes sense given how few people were doing it when he was doing it. A lot of people had that story. You know, like Bruce Levine wrote a great piece for the website about how he championed his cause, first person to put him on the radio.
Right.
David Kaplan, as big of a sports media personality as there is in this city, right? Multimedia, a lot of similar Chet Kopic mannerisms in some way.
Some call him Chet Jr.
In some way, right? But saying that he gave him his start.
Sorry, Mitch.
And those sort of things. Like, it's you were obviously his producer and worked directly with him for a long, long time. But there's a lot of people that if you credited with a tree.
Yes.
Right? Like Chet Kopic's tree in Chicago media has a hell of a lot of. And you know, Mac, I love trees.
You do love the tree, Andy Reid or otherwise.
I love trees with branches and limbs and leaves, and you are a big branch on that man's big tree.
Well, it's an honor. There are lots of branches. Mark Giangreco's kind of on the tree, kind of. Mark was employed on the air, but Chet was the top dog when Mark was a reporter at Channel 5, and then Chet couldn't be coached. He didn't get 4 minutes and 10 seconds, didn't mean 4 minutes and 52 seconds. You don't want to be late for the Tonight Show. That's a bad idea.
Yeah, TV, you can't
they
be late.
They couldn't coach him. He worked at Channel 5, and he was making money and I was away at school, so I missed all this. This is early 80s. They couldn't get, it was 36 months. Where he was just printing money, but he couldn't follow the rules. And
my guess is he was never light. He was always long with his time.
Oh, yeah.
He never came in under. Yeah. Like, hey, Chet, we need you to fill 30 seconds. My guess is that man went long.
He was verbose. He could talk.
Yeah, well, it's a gift. Did he have any regrets?
I don't know. I'd only be speculating. Let me give that some thought, and maybe we'll hit it again later in the week, a time or two. I'll mention the funeral arrangements as soon as I have them tomorrow.
You just mentioned O'Donnell's piece, and you mentioned the burned bridges, and that there were plenty of people who didn't have anything nice to say about him. I wonder if he had regrets on that because of where the career ended up and that sort of thing.
Yeah, he did not like being on the outside. And because he'd been on the inside, and it was painful for him to not get opportunities. But he brought a lot of that on himself. And I give the Blackhawks, Jay Blunk, and John McDonough a ton of credit for at least giving him a place to feel like he had a family. And he was good in that situation as a sort of a diplomat to MC lunches and things like that. That was perfect for him because he's good in that environment.
Bottom of the hour. Yeah, right. That'll take some getting used to. Bottom of the hour on the score, brought to you by Northwestern Football. Join the Big Ten West Division champion Northwestern Wildcats at Ryan Field this fall. Matchups include Ohio State and Iowa. Season tickets on sale now at nusports.com. We have some Cubs Network radio audio to get through, and the White Sox made Sunday Night Baseball. So we got some baseball audio from both sides of town to get to. It's McNeil and Parkins on the Score.
Ron, we always enjoy visiting with you. We thank you for the time, and good luck the rest of the way this year.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you guys having me on.
Roberto Perez with a two-out single into right field. Back-to-back hits for the first time in the game for Cleveland. Trying to put something together with two out now for the number nine hitter, Tyler Naquin.
And Matt, you know, just putting a button on Ron Washington, what an exceptional career he's had.
Yes! You need some salsa on that bun.
Yes, salsa up that bun! Put it on his
just
head.
Putting a button on Ron Washington.
Putting a bun on it.
The rabbit in the hats. The salsa.
Yeah, he wants some more salsa.
Jason,
that's
Witten
a meatball right there.
With the rabbit in the hat?
Yes.
A rabbit in the head?
Yes. A-Rod with the putting the bun on it. Hey, it's a chalice.
I like it.
Or a
well,
chalet.
Right.
Chalice.
Yeah.
Could happen to anybody. A-Rod.
A shallot.
Jason Witten.
Bernie Brewer.
Just putting a bun on Ron Washington.
Put a bun on Bernie Brewer as he's evicted from his shallot. You are a special one.
We're professional speakers, allegedly. So the White Sox make the Sunday Night Baseball broadcast for the Tim Anderson controversy that you missed, basically.
I love it.
I'm sure you do.
I'll talk it all day if you want to spend the rest of the show on it. The White Sox have an identity as a result of it. It ain't necessarily the one you'd most want to have, but it's an identity. They're being discussed. They're rallying around each other, it appears. Sometimes the dumbest-ass stuff gets athletes, professional and otherwise, to pull together a little bit more. Well, if that's what this winds up doing, so be it.
Well, is it a reputation that you don't want to have? Like, what did he do wrong?
Well, what I meant was I'd rather have them have a reputation for having a kick-ass baseball team.
And, oh, well, that's obviously.
Yeah, that's what I meant. You know, seeing Jimenez, you know, get to be the player he's supposed to be, and Moncada continue to do everything, and the pitching staff continue to grow.
Right. If you're going to be known for something, you want to be known as a team that's going to hit hundreds of home runs or have the best pitching staff or whatever. But if
they got fire.
They got swag.
Yeah, they do.
Or at least one guy does.
It's the bat flip. Shep and I talked about that, Tanny, in on a 2 on Friday for our 32-minute Cubs post. And just I think it needs a better name than bat flip. I like bat slam best. But
for what Tim Anderson did?
Yes.
Yeah, it was exaggerated. Whatever it was, it was
aggressive.
No,
it was it to show up the opposition? Maybe. So what? People been showing each other up for, you know, is that all of a sudden that's wrong? No, I didn't have a problem with the pitcher hitting him on the hip either. He gave him first base for free. Thank you. Didn't hit him in the head. I'd had a real problem if it was above the waist.
Right. I think the logic is, you know, he hit him in the hip or the ass or whatever, and if he misses, then he could hit him in the head. He could hit him in a dangerous place. Like, the punishment for hitting a home run shouldn't be that you wear one 94 miles an hour. It should be the next time up they try to strike you out.
It should be.
Right. And so that's why.
I think it's a cowardly act. I've never I've never liked it, but I understand. They believe it's part of their culture. So why would we, who don't live in their world, question it?
Well,
just like hockey players, 95% of them still want fighting. Okay, have it. It's your world.
Things evolve, though. Things change, right? Football players want hits to the head. Well, probably we've learned about concussions and subconcussive hits, right? Sometimes you need people to protect you from yourself. Like, we have seatbelt laws. A lot of people are just go. I don't need to wear a helmet while I motorcycle. Like, sometimes we do need protections in society to protect ourselves from ourselves, right?
If they started to toss guys every time they threw close after a player went yard on them, I'm not going to fight it. I don't think it's the right thing to do, but, you know, baseball players believe in policing the game themselves. That's what they've, that's the vernacular they've always chosen.
The unwritten rules.
Yeah. It was a good hard fastball. Hit him right on the hip.
Oh no, he executed it correctly in their messed up world. I would like them to come to a point of like, to me, it would be better if he tried to strike him out instead of hitting him. And then if he strikes him out, he talks trash back to Tim Anderson. Give him a little fist pump. Give him a little jaw action. Actually get a sustained rivalry. This way it ends.
Do a glove slam. Throw your glove down right at his feet.
Tip your hat at him. Like do something. But now it ends. Because there's everyone comes onto the field, no one really does anything. Then there's the suspensions and
lots
no punches
of milling around. Slow dancing.
And then there's warnings given out so you can't throw inside again. And so then it just ends. If he strikes him out and then trash talks Tim Anderson, and then after the game's like, yeah, he showed us up for a meaningless bat flip in whatever inning it was, then that's the foundation of a rivalry that can build. But let's hear what the national perspective was, because the White Sox, let's be honest, the ESPN forgot about the World Series. They don't get a ton of Sunday night baseball coverage. These are some of the biggest names in baseball broadcasting discussing the White Sox.
And Alex, I'll go right to you, who hit almost 700 of them. To flip or not to flip, where do you stand on this suddenly very important issue in baseball?
Look, I'm all for it. I think if you flip and you do it with honor and respect and joy and passion, I'm all for it. You know, I think that you cross the line when you start staring people down and you start, you know, showing people up. I think there's a way of doing it where it's awesome. You're celebrating with your fans and your teammates, and it's good to play with passion. I love the classic because everyone lets it fly, and yes, it's great for baseball.
Well, the one that everybody's talking about Wednesday, the Tim Anderson flip, it was micro-scrutinized and broken down and analyzed like it was the Zapruder film. So apparently what got everybody irate, Buster, and feel free to chime in here, was the fact that when he flipped it past the catcher and kind of across the plate into the other direction, even though he had no choice because that's where his dugout was. Then he wears one in the hip, and there's suspensions and ejections and fines, and here we are talking about 5 days later.
Yeah, that's where we are with the unwritten rules, guys. Not only the question of whether or not you can bat flip, but there's now bat flip etiquette. You have to do it the right way. If you just flipped it, that's fine, but if you actually throw the bat like a javelin toward your own dugout, that's going to get the ire of the other team. The Royals had issues with Tim Anderson last year. Look, the other day I interviewed CC Sabathia on my podcast, and he said, I love it. And he talked exactly, Alex, just as you did, about the World Baseball Classic watching Team Puerto Rico.
Matt, to answer your question, I mean, I'm fifth all-time in the history of the game in strikeouts. And I had never had a problem with a pitcher just doing this. Now, it's different if he's staring me all the way down to the dugout. That's different. But if he's excited and he goes about his business, I'm on to my next at-bat. And I think there's a fine line, but I do think, Buster, that there is some etiquette, and there's a way of doing it where you're celebrating the game, you're celebrating the home run, and my gosh, it is hard to hit, especially with these great pitchers throwing hard. When you hit a home run, celebrate it, do it the right way.
I don't get it.
Yeah, listen.
The right way.
It's
with respect and passion.
It's this unwritten rules thing. Everybody has a different line.
Do it the right way.
It's like people who are policing comedy. They're like, oh, you're over the line. Well, you're not over the comedian's line. Right? Everyone's
there
got a different
line.
Everyone's got a different line.
Yeah.
So everyone's got a different threshold for what
there is some etiquette. And there's a way of doing it where you're celebrating the game.
I don't know what that means.
I don't know what it means either. I think it's all a lot of nonsense. I really do.
I do too. And baseball needs more of it.
Yes, it does.
That's the ironic part of the
totally
whole thing.
I totally agree.
It actually needs more of it. Now, part of the reason it became such a big thing is because they threw at him and the benches emptied and there were suspensions and the managers got into it. So part of the reason there is this much attention on it is because the Royals didn't just take it. And so I acknowledge that. But Tim Anderson is what baseball needs more of.
And oddly, it was the NFL that recently decided it was going to relax a little bit on celebrations two seasons ago. And you get teams like the Minnesota Vikings playing leapfrog, and guys, when the Eagles did the bowling pins. I mean, just a lot of fun stuff out there. You're right. That is fun. But baseball, I don't know. There's what did he say specifically with passion and respect, just talking out of his ass. A-Rod, that's your guy.
It is my guy. I think he's a good analyst. Yeah, that's fine.
I think if you flip and you do it with honor and respect and joy and passion, I'm all for it.
Yeah,
let me see if I got all those down. Honor, respect, joy, and passion.
That's A-Rod's line. Then someone else will have a different line.
I'm really enjoying this.
And somehow Tim Anderson gets ejected for hitting a home run and then getting hit by a pitch and then gets suspended for language. So he is more punished than anyone else in the entire thing when he's the guy that baseball promotes on its social media channels, and he's the guy who hit a home run, and he's the guy in a league that's 7.8% black who's leading the league in hitting, who baseball needs more of, and they need him to become a star, and he's the one who gets punished most in this whole thing. I find how baseball's handled this from Jump Street to be ridiculous. I think the bat flip stuff is crazy. I think the suspensions are crazy. I think the language part lacks a tremendous amount of context and nuance that they could have actually had a worthwhile conversation over. And I just think they're cutting off their nose to spite their face, because baseball needs to celebrate Tim Anderson, not punish him.
You know, if you want to get into the language element of it, I'll be your huckleberry on that.
I did it last night. I did it last night for an hour on the national show. I find it to be an interesting conversation. I thought James Fegan wrote a great piece at The Athletic. There was a great column in the New York Daily News. I think that baseball and that word being said in that context by a black person has a different meaning than if a white person had said it as a racial slur. I'm not saying he meant it as a compliment, obviously. The guy hit him 94 miles an hour on the hip. But understanding context and nuance isn't a bad thing. The world isn't black and white. There's a lot of gray. And by having a uniform policy of this word bad, therefore suspension.
There are some words that kind of fall into that category, though, Danny, and that's one of them.
Okay. And if that's the world we're going to live in, that to me doesn't do us any good. It doesn't do us any good to not understand that words have different meanings based on intent and who is using them. Period. Like, I fundamentally believe that. I'm not saying, listen, it's not my place to say it. It's not my word. I've got no interest in ever saying it. It's obviously.
I have defended use of words, not necessarily my own in the past, but I have come around to accepting the majority opinion of if it is hurtful to a large percentage of people, more than half who hear it, best to leave it out.
And I don't know how we determine. I mean, is it half? Is it 5%?
Right.
Is it 1%?
Does it have honor, joy, passion, and respect? Does it meet the A-Rod bat flip criteria?
I think if you flip and you do it with honor and respect and joy and passion, I'm all for it.
Right. That's it. That's just total nonsense. But I just think it lacks understanding and context and nuance. And when, generally speaking, salute. No one learns in that way when you're going to say it's the exact same. Tim Anderson saying, you're a weak ass effing N-word with a GA at the end. That's the same as a white guy yelling it from the stands at a black player with an ER at the end. They're not the same thing. And I don't believe they should be policed the same way. And I think baseball missed an opportunity. And they don't explain anything, also.
Part of this story that makes it so baseball.
There's no Joe Torre interview. There's no explanation. The NFL has Dean Blandino out there. They do video reviews of penalties. The NBA releases a 2-minute report to grade the officials on big calls at the end of the game. Baseball's just like, oh, yeah, there's a suspension. And Jeff Passan has to get an anonymous source to tell him what Tim Anderson allegedly said.
Right.
Like, that doesn't help anybody. And so I think it was a weak move by baseball and lacking some understanding for context. But I got my fill of it last night, frankly.
Okay.
Yeah, I got my fill of it last night. It's it's better if everyone's in on the conversation. And I think in this type of setting, it can be it can lead down some conversational roads that some people are uncomfortable with. But it is what it is. We will get to – you want to do a draft, given that it's draft week?
I think on draft week, we should do a draft every day. Since the Bears don't have a pick, at least as of yet, until number 87, and I expect that to change because Ryan's a wheeler and a dealer.
At least one draft every day.
At least a draft every day. Well, it is draft week.
Well, it is draft day.
Maybe there's more to come. It's McNeil and Parkins on the Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.